It's really funny how we judge a book by its cover. Or, well, in this case, like a life by its exterior.
Oh, absolutely. We do it all the time.
Right. Because if you were to drive past a perfectly normal, quiet, suburban house, you'd probably assume the people living inside have a perfectly normal, quiet life. You imagine Sunday dinners and lawn maintenance and just predictable routines.
Yeah, the standard American dream setup.
Exactly. But imagine walking up to that extremely ordinary-looking house, opening the front door, and finding a literal looping high-speed roller coaster just taking up the entire living room.
Sparks flying everywhere.
Yes, cars careening upside down, total exhilarating chaos. I mean, that is exactly what it feels like to read the unpublished 2026 memoir we're taking a deep dive into today.
It really is.
Yeah.
The book is titled Keeping Up with the Joneses, and the subtitle is The Extraordinary Journey of a Very Ordinary Couple.
A very ordinary couple.
Right, which is funny because the author, Karen Fitzgerald Jones, she spends the entire introduction actively fighting against the idea that she or her late husband, Reverend Bill Jones, are anything special at all.
She's super adamant about it.
She is. She explicitly writes, we are not famous. We are just ordinary people. But the second you start turning the pages, you realize their 53-year love story completely defies logic.
It really does. It reads less like a quiet suburban diary and
Yeah.
way more like a cinematic thriller, honestly.
Yeah, written by an author with just a wildly overactive imagination, it is packed to the brim with bizarre coincidences, near-death experiences, and, well, moments of seemingly divine intervention.
So the mission for our deep dive today is to explore the anatomy of this extraordinary connection. And I think what makes this project so compelling is we aren't just getting Karen's polished, retrospective thoughts from 50 years later.
Right, the glossed over version.
Exactly. We are getting the raw data. Karen kept two literal boxes of unpolished, handwritten love letters from when she and Bill were just 18 years old, and she chose to include them in the manuscript completely raw.
Typos and all.
The typos, the teenage angst, the dramatic declarations, it is all in there.
What's fascinating here is the sheer vulnerability of that choice. I mean, most memoirists writing in their later years, they just cannot resist the urge to apply a coat of varnish to their younger
Oh,
selves.
totally. We all want to look smarter in hindsight.
Right. They want to appear more mature or more prophetic or just more put together than they actually were. But by leaving the letters untouched, Karen promises us this deeply unfiltered look at human connection. We are going to see the exact messy, completely unrevised moments where their lives collided.
And to understand why they clashed so hard when they finally met in college, we really have to look at the psychological framing they both grew up with. Because you don't just wake up one day and embrace a roller coaster life.
No, you really have to be primed for it.
You are primed for it. Both Bill and Karen had childhoods that fundamentally hardwired them to expect the universe to just interrupt their plans. The circumstances were completely different, but the resulting worldview was strangely parallel, marked by sheer survival and incredibly strict convictions.
Well, and Bill's entrance into the world alone establishes that theme of sudden interruption. He was born in North Carolina in October 1954, just 5 days before Hurricane Hazel made landfall.
That was a catastrophic Category 4 storm.
Huge storm.
Yeah.
And his mother, Pinky, she was 41 years old when she got pregnant. For months, she actually thought she was just experiencing the onset of menopause or some strange illness.
Wait, she didn't even know she was pregnant.
Right. So before he even takes his first breath, he's a massive disruption to his parents' reality.
Wow. And then at 5 days old, the actual hurricane hits.
Yeah. The storm is tearing the neighborhood apart outside, and baby Bill is asleep in a crib positioned near an exterior wall in his parents' bedroom.
Which is terrifying.
It is. And someone in the family looks at the flexing walls and decides it is simply too dangerous to leave a newborn near the glass. So they rush in, scoop the 5-day-old baby up, and move him to the center hallway of the house.
Thank goodness.
And mere seconds after his tiny body is lifted out of that crib, a massive piece of corrugated sheet metal is ripped from a nearby roof by the hurricane winds.
Oh my
It
God.
comes flying through the bedroom window and completely shatters the glass, burying the empty crib in jagged debris.
Mere seconds. I mean, think about the psychological impact of that family lore. He grows up knowing his first brush with fate happened at 5 days old. Survival was literally a matter of inches and seconds.
Exactly. And while Bill's early life is defined by surviving a literal hurricane, Karen's upbringing in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia was defined by navigating life with this fierce, almost unyielding sense of survival-driven purpose.
Because her parents were incredibly young, right?
Yeah, only 18 when she was born. And early in her life, her father suffered a severe factory injury that kept him out of work for nearly a year.
That's devastating for a young family.
It was. She watched her young family fight tooth and nail just to keep food on the table. That environment forged a highly independent, hardworking mindset. She learned early on that you have to take control of your destiny because the ground beneath you can fall away at any moment.
Which makes what happens when Karen is 14 years old so incredibly jarring. So she's deeply in love with a boy in her hometown. It's a serious foundational teenage romance.
Right.
But she's at a church camp in Dublin, Virginia. And during an evening service, she feels this profound, undeniable internal directive from God. The message she feels echoing in her mind is simply, end it. End it now.
Just out of nowhere.
Yeah, the overwhelming sense is that she must sever this relationship to protect her ultimate future. So she goes home, breaks this poor boy's heart, and shatters her own heart in the process.
And the emotional fallout was severe. I mean, Karen writes that her own mother wept over the breakup because absolutely nobody in their circle understood it. It defied all rational logic.
Okay, let's unpack this. Wait. She ends a serious, loving relationship at 14 based on internal feeling at a summer camp.
Yes.
Isn't that an almost unbelievable amount of conviction for a teenager? I mean, most 14-year-olds are entirely consumed by high school cafeteria politics, and she is making massive, trajectory-altering life choices based on a spiritual intuition.
It is an immense amount of conviction, but if we connect this to the bigger picture, we really have to understand the deeply religious framework Karen and Bill were both raised in.
Right.
In their worldview, life is not just a series of random, chaotic events tumbling into one another. Both of them were steeped in an environment that emphasized divine calling.
Because Bill had grandfathers who were ministers, right?
Yeah, Bill had two grandfathers who were deeply spiritual men. One a respected pastor, one a faithful deacon, and his mother openly prayed for him to carry their mantles. And Karen, similarly, had been taught to surrender her future.
So they were basically trained for this.
Exactly. These early experiences built a framework where they learned to trust invisible forces over their immediate, tangible comforts. Karen didn't possess the maturity to fully articulate the why at 14, but she trusted the directive anyway.
And so, when you put two highly convicted teenagers with intense internal lives on the same campus, you expect an epic cinematic collision.
Naturally.
They inevitably cross paths in the fall of 1972 at Emmanuel College in Franklin Springs, Georgia. But instead of fireworks and a glorious meet-cute, the universe gives them a scenario that is practically, comically anticlimactic.
Yeah, so Karen arrives at Emmanuel College a year early. She bypassed the 11th grade entirely by grinding through a summer math class, landing on campus at just 17 years old.
Which is so impressive.
It is. And to help pay her tuition, she takes a work-study job in the admissions office. So one afternoon, she's manually sorting through a stack of student data cards with a friend. And she pulls a card for a freshman from North Carolina.
William Noel Jones.
Yes. She and her friend look at the spelling, N-O-Y-E-L-L, and they absolutely lose it.
They just crack up.
They start laughing, joking, no yell. What kind of name is that?
I mean, it's the 1970s equivalent of accidentally seeing your future spouse's highly embarrassing, cringy email address before you actually meet them in person.
Exactly.
It completely undermines any romantic mystique before he even enters the room.
And their actual first face-to-face meeting does absolutely nothing to restore that mystique. They end up registered for the same early morning honors English class.
Uh-oh.
Karen and her friends are sitting at their table. They've woken up early, showered, done their makeup, and are presenting their best selves. Suddenly, the door swings open and in stumbles Bill Jones.
He looks like an absolute disaster.
Homeless.
Karen notes his thick black hair is sticking straight up in every conceivable direction.
Yeah.
He clearly has sleep crusting in his eyes. He looks like he literally rolled out of bed, threw on whatever was on the floor, and sprinted across the quad to make the bell.
We also have to visualize Bill's physical presence here because he was not a guy who could just blend into the background. Karen describes him as having a 52-inch chest and 36-inch arms.
Wow.
He was built like a lumberjack with a round, expressive face and incredibly deep dimples. He was a very imposing figure. In fact, her father would later joke about managing him as a professional wrestler under the ring name Scarbelly.
Scarbelly! That is amazing.
But what actually catches Karen's attention isn't just his size, it's his academic trajectory. Bill was on campus to study marine biology or perhaps take over his father's small greenhouse operation and scale it into a massive, profitable horticulture business.
Right.
He loved the ocean, he loved working with plants, and he had zero intention of going into the ministry.
Okay, we have to pause here and explain exactly why his secular career ambition is the most important thing in the world to Karen.
Yes, this is crucial.
Karen had established a non-negotiable rule for her life. She would never, ever marry a preacher. And for you listening today, that might just sound like a quirky preference. But in the context of the 1970s Southern evangelical culture, marrying a small-town pastor was practically a vow of poverty.
Yeah, the reality of being a pastor's wife, living in the church parsonage, was incredibly daunting. A parsonage is a house owned by the church, provided for the pastor's family.
Right.
That meant the congregation effectively acted as your landlord. They often supplied the furniture. They felt entitled to drop by unannounced at any hour of the day. Your entire existence was a fishbowl.
Literally living in a glass house.
Exactly. Every dollar you spent, the car you drove, the length of the skirt you wore, it was all scrutinized by a church board. Karen had watched women morph into these perfectly prim, financially struggling versions of June Cleaver just to survive the pressure.
It is essentially the 1970s version of being a micro-influencer, where your followers pay your rent and feel fully entitled to police your daily life, but without any of the glamour.
That's a perfect analogy.
Karen explicitly writes that her dream was to marry a man with a highly successful career so they can be the philanthropists. She wanted to be the one donating the money to build the new church fellowship hall, not the one relying on the offering plate for her groceries.
Right.
So Bill's dreams of marine biology or a lucrative greenhouse business made him fundamentally safe.
And because his ambitions align perfectly with her safety protocols, Karen gives herself permission to start falling for him. But Bill is completely oblivious.
Completely in the dark.
Yeah. And Karen's attempts to force the narrative and get his attention lead to a string of absolute disasters, both physical and emotional.
Oh, man. The art of trying way too hard. Let's look at the gym incident.
It's so bad.
Karen gets a tip that Bill might be hanging out at the campus gym one evening playing basketball. So she drags her best friend Paula all the way across campus to casually bump into him.
As one does.
Naturally. The only problem is Bill never shows up.
Mm-hmm.
Karen is killing time, messing around and trying to playfully scare another student. She ducks and she forcefully smashes her head into a massive rusted screw sticking out from under the wooden bleachers.
And it is a severe, bloody injury. She has to be rushed to the emergency room. And to properly stitch the wound, the ER nurse is forced to shave a highly visible circle of hair right off the crown of her head.
She is walking around a college campus with 7 stitches and a glaring bald spot.
All to impress a boy who wasn't even in the building.
That is just brutal.
And the physical humiliation is merely the opening act for the emotional devastation.
Oh, right. It gets worse.
Much worse. After the Christmas break, she returns to campus. She is deeply in love with him, but still nursing that bald spot and her heavily wounded pride.
Ouch.
One afternoon, she is sitting in the cafeteria with her friends. Her back is to the windows, but her friends see Bill walking across the campus quad heading straight for the building. They start whispering and giving Karen these frantic signals, fully convinced he is finally coming over to sit with her.
And Bill walks in, grabs his tray, walks right past Karen's table, and sits down with her friends instead, completely ignoring her.
The public rejection shatters her. Her friends give her that agonizing, pitiful, poor Karen look. Humiliated, she grabs her tray, fights back tears, practically runs to the tray return, and flees the cafeteria entirely.
She just bolts.
She runs straight down into the damp basement prayer room of her dormitory.
I mean, it is universally relatable to embarrass yourself for a college crush. We have all been there.
Oh, absolutely.
But getting a bald spot shaved into your head and then getting blatantly ignored in a crowded cafeteria, that is next level tragedy. How do you recover from that?
This raises an important question about the architecture of our lives. Why do our biggest life shifts, you know, the massive plot twists, almost always happen the moment after we hit rock bottom and completely give up?
It's so true.
Because that is exactly what Karen does in that basement. She begs God to take away her feelings for Bill. She confesses that the whole thing is an embarrassment, a joke, and she demands that the longing be removed from her heart. She prays for hours, fully surrendering her desire.
But the feelings do not vanish.
No, the feelings remain. But what does happen is an emotional clearing. The anxiety of trying to control the situation just evaporates. She stops trying to force the narrative. She accepts defeat.
Yeah.
And that deep psychological surrender is the exact required setup for the climax of their story, which happens mere days later.
Karen refers to this climax in the memoir as the trick. She's given up control. But fate, or as Karen frames it, God's sharp sense of humor, has this massive curveball waiting. It is January 6, 1973, just a few days after her tearful basement prayer.
Right.
The college is hosting a powerful multi-day revival service.
And during the service, Bill goes down to the altar. He experiences something known within their tradition as the baptism of the Holy Spirit. Karen takes a moment in the text to carefully contextualize this for readers who might not share their religious background. She clarifies that this was not some chaotic, wild spectacle. For Bill, it was a profoundly quiet, life-altering moment of total surrender to his calling.
Service concludes, and the crowd begins to filter out. Karen is sitting completely alone on a small pew in the wing of the sanctuary. She watches Bill get up from the altar and start walking up the aisle. Given everything that has happened, she fully expects him to walk right past her, exactly like he did in the cafeteria.
Instead, he alters his path. He walks straight up to her and sits right beside her.
Yeah.
There are still people milling about the room, but he singles her out and he drops an absolute bomb.
Oh, man.
He looks at her and says, God did something special in my life tonight. I accepted a call to preach.
Her world stops spinning. Think about the sheer cognitive dissonance of this moment. Her ultimate nightmare, becoming the June Cleaver pastor's wife, living in the glass house of a parsonage, subjecting herself to the poverty she feared, is suddenly attached to the very man she has hopelessly fallen in love with.
It's her worst fear coming true.
Exactly. The lumberjack she thought was going to be a wealthy marine biologist has just vaporized her life plan.
But Bill doesn't even give her a second to process the destruction of her meticulously crafted future, because in the exact same breath, without skipping a beat, he casually pivots and asks her, are you hungry? Want to go to the canteen and get a bite to eat?
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. Despite the panic alarms blaring in her head, she says yes.
She goes with him.
They go eat. He is finally looking at her, talking directly to her. And Karen realizes in that little canteen that she has been masterfully played, God effectively tricked her by making her fall head over heels for Bill before he announced his calling to the ministry.
It is an analysis of brilliant, necessary timing. If you look at Karen's rigid prejudices, if Bill had walked up to her on the first day of college, extended his hand, and said, hi, I'm a ministerial student, she would have sprinted in the opposite direction.
Oh, she would have run for the hills.
She actually includes a letter she wrote to her parents early in the semester, complaining about how bold the ministerial students were.
Right. They were relentless.
They were constantly prowling the campus, asking girls if they knew how to play the piano, essentially interviewing them for the unpaid role of pastor's wife. Her father actually wrote back and told her to lie to them and say she didn't know how to play.
Lie to the ministers. Mm. I absolutely love that detail. The trick was the only way to bypass her stubborn defenses. God had to get her completely hooked on the man before revealing the vocation.
Yep.
And it works. By February 21st, 1973, just over a month later, her transformation is complete. We actually have an excerpt from one of the letters she wrote to him on that day.
It's a beautiful letter.
It reads, Bill, I know what you are being called to do, and I know how hard it will be. But I love you enough to wait the 4 long years it will take you to finish your degree. My plans don't matter anymore. I don't care if we live in a mansion or a shack. I will marry you whether you are a minister standing behind a pulpit or a ditch digger covered in mud. I'm yours.
Whether a minister or a ditch digger. I mean, it is a total profound capitulation of her ego. The girl who demanded wealth and safety eagerly signs up for a life of service and unpredictability just because the connection is undeniable.
So what does this all mean? For you listening, think about your own rigid life plans. We all have them. The lists you've meticulously made, the boundaries you've drawn in the sand, the I will never take that kind of job or I will never date that kind of person.
The rules we make for ourselves.
Right. Karen's story is this striking reminder of how our strictest boundaries are often joyfully dismantled by love and unexpected circumstances. Giving up control and letting go of how things are supposed to look might just be the best career and relationship move you can possibly make.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture of their lives, that surrender was really just the starting line. There is one final mind-bending detail hidden in the foreword of this memoir that perfectly encapsulates how wild this ride gets.
This part is insane.
The foreword is written by Reba Rambo, the Grammy and Dove award-winning Christian singer. And Reba recounts a bizarre experience she had while visiting Karen and Bill's church in Georgia years into their marriage, long before they had any children.
Okay.
During a service, Reba looks over at Karen and is struck by a vivid, inexplicable vision. She sees the ceiling of the sanctuary literally open up, and a baby falls out of the sky, tumbling through a white sheet, landing directly into Karen's waiting arms.
Wow.
It was so intense that Reba called Karen to the front of the church to declare what she saw.
And then 5 entire years pass. Reba and the Joneses do not speak. They live completely separate lives.
5 years later, Reba is ministering across the country in San Jose, California. She is introduced to a pregnant young woman living in a home for unwed mothers. Instantly, the geography and time just melt away.
Unbelievable.
Reba is transported back to that vision from Georgia. She somehow knows with absolute terrifying certainty that this young woman is carrying the specific baby she saw falling into Karen's arms.
And this is way before social media or cell phones.
In a pre-internet world, Reba manages to track Bill and Karen down across the country to ask them one profound question. Do you want to have a baby?
And through a dizzying sequence of events that Reba describes as miracles of biblical proportions, that exact baby from San Jose becomes their adopted son, William Blake.
When you look at how a memoirist processes these events, it all comes back to that initial lesson of surrender. If just the act of getting together involved shattered glass, shaved heads, divine tricks, and basement prayers.
Yeah, that's a lot of chaos just to start dating.
And if starting their family involved cross-country visions from Grammy-winning singers, it leaves you with a staggering thought. Once you agree to step onto the roller coaster and give up control over the steering wheel, there is truly no limit to how extraordinary and ordinary life can become.
You really cannot judge a book by its cover. You look at the Joneses and you see that perfectly normal, quiet suburban house. But as we've learned today, when you finally open the front door, you better be strapped in for the ride.